listening to the Cricket Podcast.
I think it was a disgraceful performance, and I think it should never be permitted to happen again.
That is very good.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Cricket Podcast, where this week we'll be flying through a load of cricket. We've got a recap of the third test between India and England. We've got a preview of the fourth test between India and England. And we've got some white ball action from New Zealand. And you know what? I think we might have time for a little bit of PSL as well. I'm Jack Cope. And as ever, I'm joined by Ed Sheeran impersonator, Max Roe Brown. How are you doing?
Who's that? Very good. Thank you, Jack. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. And Tim Payne impersonator, Ross Legg.
G'day, mate.
I have to say, in the comments, I get the Tim Payne. I don't understand the Tim Payne impersonator bit.
No. I've always thought that Ross looked a bit like Marcus Alonso, but...
Let us know in the comments. I'm sure you will. Anyway, we are excited about the cricket, aren't we? It's because the game only lasted 2 days, it feels like we've had a little bit of a drought.
Yeah, we sort of had about the normal gap you'd get between test matches, which is obviously too long.
It is, yeah. I'm glad. I think they should up it. When the games end early, they should do something else. Before we get into the proper cricket, fellas, we've got our kind of pointless question of the week. The icebreaker, if you will. And this week, it's birthday themed. Yesterday, the cricket podcast turned 2, which is an accomplishment. The longest we've ever stuck at a project, I'd say. My question to you two, start with you, Max. What cricket-themed present would you like for your cricket podcast birthday?
Well, I'm afraid it's a bit of a serious answer, I suppose. Nothing too silly and jokey. I would like a bowling machine, and I will tell you why I would like a bowling machine. It's because it's getting sunny now, and we've just been told that we might be allowed out to play soon, and that's got me thinking about playing cricket and going to cricket nets. And for the club I play for, the frontline bowlers, one in particular, just doesn't actually believe in cricket nets as practice, but all the batsmen go to nets, so you generally end up with one bowler at the nets and then about six batsmen. Obviously the one bowler gets very tired after about 10 minutes because he's bowling a lot, and then you're just basically, when you go into bat, you're just playing really shit off spin for 15 minutes, and it's crap. So I'd like a bowling machine so I can face some proper bowling in the nets.
Good answer. I can see that. Where are you going to store it? I mean, we know you're about to become a homeowner. Congratulations. Yeah. What does your girlfriend, soon-to-be fiancé, and slightly less soon-to-be wife think about this?
She's not yet been informed.
Okay. Does that mean a cricket net in the back garden is a possibility?
Well, you might have to. It's a bit on a bit of a slope, so I might have to build up the back a bit. But it's certainly the right dimensions for a cricket net.
Yeah, fair enough. Look, it never hurt Lord's slope, did it? If anything...
Different direction, that slope, though.
That's the main selling point. Ross Legg, what would you like for your cricket podcast, cricket birthday?
I'd quite like a bust made out of cricket balls. I think that'd be quite a bust of me, and someone has done the little leather cricket balls, and we can make a bust. That'd be quite a niche, weird present to get.
Cool. That's so weird, it's knocked me.
Yeah, good. Or we had Jack Russell on the podcast way back when. I wouldn't mind one of his a portrait of us three together. Like, I'm not gonna be one of those naff podcasts that has like a pencil drawing outline of three people. What you want is a proper artist who's kind of gone to town and done a portrait of all three of us.
We could commission that.
Okay. Yeah, looking very regal in some whites. That'd
right.
be good, wouldn't it?
I would like an IPL franchise.
Toy money.
Aim high. before we get into the rest of the show, Ross, do you have any listeners' messages for our listeners?
Yes, you should subscribe using the buttons, whether it's left or right on the screen, I don't know. And you should follow us on all podcast platforms as well as social media platforms, where you can find us at The Cricket Pod on Twitter and Instagram.
Perfecto. If you're watching on YouTube as well, smash that like button and leave us a comment. We might agree with you. We might argue with you. We might make fun of you, depending on my mood. And if you're listening to part one of the Cricket Podcast on YouTube, you can actually listen to the whole show in advance on Spotify or Apple or wherever, because we release the videos over 2 days, but the audio over one. So, you know, get ahead of your friends and head on over to Spotify. And, you know, cross-follow. Let's build a web of interconnected...
Someone's been reading about the Internet of Things.
We will be back after a short break.
UJ 6 for 9 at Cockermouth. That's Ben Stokes' old club, isn't it? Cockermouth. 6 for 9 at UJ Cocker Cricket Club.
The third test between India and England then. Well, we basically did 2 episodes on this already because we were doing a daily show. We encourage you, you know, go back and listen to them or watch them if you want to catch our immediate reaction. But I think, you know, right now, we're going to go through some of the points in the game again, starting as ever with the Mac summary. Max, do you want to talk us through what happened over days one and ultimately two?
Yeah, it might be a slightly shorter summary than normal for obvious reasons. India and England faced off under lights in Ahmedabad at the newly crowned Narendra Modi Stadium. Talk in the run-up to the game had been dominated by the likely conditions, the pitch, the potential danger of seam with the pink ball. But before things even got started, England fans were left a little concerned while England put all of their pink eggs in one basket by picking 3 seamers and seemingly no batsmen. India stuck with 3 spinners and recalled Washington Sundar to add some more batting. So 2 very different approaches there. One taken by the home team, who knew what the pitch was going to be like. Things started well enough for England. We won the toss. That was good. Zach Crawley's 50 looked really nice. And Bumrah and Ishant definitely got a bit of movement out the pink ball in the first 10 overs or so. So, yeah, all things considered, at the start it looked promising for England. But 15 overs in, it all went very, very wrong and very quickly. The pink ball stopped moving, Axar and Ashwin came on, and then England were all out. And it happened about that quickly. It didn't improve in the evening either, because England's seamers tried to extract some life from the pitch and ultimately failed. 10 overs in, they could barely even stand up while they were trying to bowl. And England belatedly turned to Jack Leach, who confirmed everyone's suspicions by taking a couple of wickets. And everyone could see that England had got it badly, badly wrong. And India were 13 behind with 7 wickets in hand. So that was game over on day one. And then in the second 40% of the game, enter Joe Rutilitharan, as he's now been called, who bamboozled the Indian batsman with his well-renowned, world-class skill with off-spin and took 5 for 8 to drag England back into the game. But the hope was dashed as quickly as it returned. England found themselves 0 for 2 after 2 unplayable deliveries that went in a straight line. And England meekly limped to 81, allowing Rohit and Gill to knock off the remaining 49 runs with impudence, and everyone was home in time for tea. So, yeah, that left sort of England scratching their heads and Channel 4 wondering what they would need to do to fill 28 hours of programming.
About 400 episodes of Four in a Bed, I think is what they went with.
Come dine with me, Frasier.
Like how they feel every day. The key points I think we should probably touch on as talking points. The selection, England's avant-garde approach to selecting a team in India. the opportunities for England to actually win, because there were a couple, I think, in the match, and probably we'll have a little chat again about the pitch, although we did cover that on podcast 2 of the Daily Duo. Ross, England's selection, if we're going to summarise it, they got it wrong, didn't they?
That's a fair assumption to make, really. I think England's rotation policy, I think, is ultimately admirable. I think they're trying to do the right thing. But there needs to be some questions around how they've actually deployed the resources they've had available during the whole of the winter, really. But my first question is kind of, in what world does a team get rolled for 134, then 166 with 8 batsmen and 3 number 11s? And then the leadership team of a team goes, do you know what? We're going to pick one fewer batsman and have another number 11. but there's no real logic there for me. What is difficult is that when we did the preview show, we said there was a couple of different options available to them. And we thought that, like most of the media, and probably the most of the England team, based upon their selection, that the pink ball would move around and they'd get a bit more of a friendly pitch to play some seamers on. Fortunately, the media and us don't pick the team. It's the England management team. However, on this occasion, I think we would have done a better job.
Would we?
I don't know. I feel like in our preview podcast, we might have all come around to the argument of playing the longer tail and four seamers, because we were very much of the opinion, weren't we, of, yeah, put all the eggs in one basket, because it's the best chance we'd have of actually getting a result with the pink ball swinging.
I think that's basically right, Max. I think basically, from England's perspective, if the ball span, if the pitch was going to be a spinner, they were going to lose if they, like, regardless of what they did. They could have picked 15 players, like someone smuggled that past the match referee. Probably wouldn't have been that difficult based on some of the umpiring decisions.
Can we just have that camera angle? No, he's going to pass the 11th player.
But they actually did have a chance of winning, I think, if the ball moved. So I think that obviously in hindsight, it looks absolutely ridiculous to be bowled out twice, haven't managed to score 200 runs in the match. The seamers barely bowled. They didn't bowl at all in the second innings. Joe Root is your second best bowler in the match. Best in terms of figures, but second best probably in terms of like the eye test. It looks really stupid. If England were going to have a chance of drawing or winning, basically, one of the last two tests, surely their best hope was that inexplicably India effed up the pitch and they got a little bit of help for Broad, Anderson and Archer, no?
But so this is the bit, look, we're doing this 5,000 miles away. Like Chris Silverwood, Joe Root, they can see the pitch. They even practiced at the ground. You can't tell me that they're sitting there going, oh, do you know what? This Modi pitch is going to be absolutely brilliant.
They did say, didn't they, some of the players while they were in warm-ups, that it was hooping around corners.
Which is great, but then at the same time, they still could just look at the pitch. Like it's going to be a thing. It's not going to be mad. But what I really like about this is, where is Ed Smith? And I know we had a bit in when we're in Australia and thinking about where's Rohit Sharma. Where is Ed Smith? Is he actually out there, or is he in kind of some opium den searching for a new way of doing some innovative selection? Because I'm really not sure what was going on in this case.
Yeah, I don't know. I think in a sense it might have been worth the gamble from England's point of view. But I also think they were properly, as we said on the last podcast, they were properly duped by India in terms of it, like, you know, the pictures of the green seamer, Umesh Yadav being called up to the India 15.
That for me was the masterstroke, calling up Umesh Yadav, because obviously, I mean, you can put out a picture of a pitch 4 or 5 or 6 days out when it's not been mowed. It doesn't mean anything, does it? Because you haven't even decided how much grass you're going to leave on it. But picking up, saying, oh yeah, we're bringing Umesh Yadav back into the squad, see if he's fit. And just leaving that inkling of doubt there. I was like, oh, well, they actually might go for 3 seamers. Because, and India do make a big thing about, you know, backing their seam attack. And they do have an absolutely phenomenal seam attack. And Umesh Yadav's, his record in India is phenomenal. So
For the past 5 years, England have been playing one big con on the England team. We've got a pretty good seam attack here. We're going and it all came down to this crux moment, so they get to the World Test Championship final. Is that what you're saying?
That wasn't quite the angle I was going for. I was sort of focusing on the Umesh Yadav.
Yeah, it was. It was a good trick. I mean, It does lead to some questions, and they're not really big questions because it happens everywhere. But, you know, is it exactly right that there's sort of ways of looking at this. I was listening to another podcast, an Indian podcast, about this match, and one of the guys on it said India realised it was going to spin, and England didn't. And I think that's an interesting way of putting it, is all I'll say, because I don't know if India realised it was going to spin. Or
or knew from the very beginning that it was going
to
spin.
Asked for it to spin. I mean, that's the only thing I'd say. I mean, it was, you know, England's selection. It was pretty funny, wasn't it? They probably got it wrong for that match.
Well, I've got one more bit on this. So England have a pretty decent history of picking and ruining a spinner in unfavourable bowling conditions. Are you surprised that they've not really given a new spinner a go? So regardless if they saw the pitch, I mean, Joe Root was standing next to the pitch where you could see that it was just dirt. So was there not ever a bit where they were just like, we don't have Moeen Ali, we don't trust Don Bess, so the likes of Parkinson Crane, I think he's in the touring party, or Verdi, could have been given a go?
I think that's a question for the next test. Maybe we should hold on to that for some content for later in the show. I think at one all, to be honest, England were entitled to take the gamble. It probably was a really dumb gamble. We're talking like 20-1 odds that it turns out all of the evidence that you're being presented with is wrong. Like England, they're probably 50-1 on a spinning wicket at the moment, aren't they? So, you know, worth a go. England did lose. We're talking about like it was a bit of an inevitability.
Mm.
I think at least one time in the match, they actually did have a chance. 74-2 on day one, and Joe Root said this in his presser after the game. To go from 74-2 to 112 all out, did they blow it?
Well, I think you can't say that a team that went from 74-2 to 112 all out didn't kind of mess up a little bit at some stage. whatever the hell is going on, whatever game you're playing, everything else aside, that is a bizarre, bizarre occurrence, especially when you had at that time Zach Crawley looking really, really well set, looking really good. Joe Root was in, England's best player of spin, and we had people. People to come like Ben Stokes, who we know all about, and I wouldn't say we were in that strong a position because of sort of in terms of a general game of cricket, like 74-2 after you've won the toss and chosen to bat isn't setting the world alight, but in the context of what ended up happening, actually it's It wasn't a bad spot to be in, and a lot of the wickets that we did lose, you would say, weren't exactly examples of high quality cricket. It seems like Ben Stokes only needs to be shown a picture of Ravi Ashwin at the moment, and it'll all come tumbling down around him. So definitely some blame on the part of England there.
Yeah, I do think that was really, in my mind, the main opportunity that England had. And I think possibly looking back on the game, 74-2, they were probably ahead of par. Like they might have actually been favourites in hindsight, if that makes sense.
Well, everything was coming out the middle of Crawley's bat. He couldn't do anything wrong, could he? He was absolutely hooning it to the boundary. It looked great.
Yeah, as you said on that show, though, you wonder if him smacking Ishan out of the attack basically preempted or precipitated the disaster that was to come. Obviously, I mean, there's not really much to add, is there? Besides saying, like, you know, losing 8-38 to throw that away was dumb.
I think there's probably an aspect, a mental aspect to that collapse. In that, at 74-2, now we can sit there and say, yeah, look, England were in a really good position based on what we saw happen. But at the time, you're 74-2. And this is sort of, you know, a couple of batsmen have struggled, and you know, you've lost Bairstow for nothing, and you've lost a review along with it. And you think actually some not panic, but some concern would set in the England team, and then when another couple fall, it does sort of build up. Whereas actually, if they were able to have the benefit of hindsight and know what the what the game was going to turn out like, they might have applied themselves in a slightly different way. But
so I read a couple of articles, actually, one on ESPN, I think, by Ian Chappell, and the other one by on The Guardian from VVS Laxman, and an interview that he did about playing spin. And I thought it was really interesting to kind of just see how his approach and how he was talking it through around where you position your bat and going playing back to the bowl or back to mid-off, whereas England's technique, their scoring shot looked to be the sweep shot. They weren't moving their feet and they were playing to cover, and that was where all kind of the issues were. And it's quite interesting to see. I mean, we've got Marcus Trescothick, who, not a bad player of spin, plays at Somerset as the batting coach. Jeeta Patel, obviously the spin bowling coach, can offer some advice. England just don't look set up for success in any which way to bat with...
Well, no, I think what you've basically nailed there, Ross, is England's main problem. So if you want to get nerdy about it, England are quite good against the spin when you're able to sweep. As it happens, the speed that Axel Patel in particular bowls at makes the sweep a really, really high-risk shot. Cricviz did one of their things where they're like, oh, when the ball is bowled slower than 90 km per hour, the sweep averages 80. Mm. When it's bowled faster than 90 km per hour, it averages 20. And Axel Patel...
It's quite an unwieldy shot to get into, isn't
it? Yeah, and Axel Patel bowls basically a bit too quickly for that. Add in the problem that the ball was not going in the same place. Despite bouncing in the same place. The sweep, you kind of wrote off England's only or main attacking shot. Anything else to add? I mean, the other time in the game England maybe thought they had a chance is when they fought back to bowl India out for just 145 and they were only 33 behind going into the third innings. Could they have won from there, or was that lead of 33 just too much for the three Lions to overcome, Ross?
My favourite thing about that moment was just the air of inevitability.
What was coming next?
Like, the roller coaster of being an England fan then, and probably being an India fan, you were just like, this is amazing. Oh my God, this is absolutely terrible. And then when Crawley got out for the first ball of the innings, it was just like, oh God, don't worry, we've got another. Oh no, it's Johnny Bairstow coming in. Oh, and he was out, what, two balls later. Wow. It was a pretty shoddy thing to happen. I did like Shane Warne's suggestion of completely changing up the batting lineup. So what would that have helped with, Shane? Like, what big brain are you using to go, oh, do you know what, sending Broad to open up?
I actually did say, I think, in one WhatsApp chat that we should just send in Ben Stokes to open and just be like, you know what, he might be able to burgle a pinch hitting 30, and then suddenly we're on par and we're in with the shout. I mean, I think the 33 run deficit was somewhat larger than obviously the number itself suggested. When you bear in mind that it was over 25% of the runs we scored in the first innings, and it was probably on another day, probably more like a lead of 80 or 100.
I think that's a massive exaggeration, to be honest. 33 runs is like, it was a difficult wicket to bat on, but if you're 33 runs behind, I think you can at most you can say that you can charge a double tax to runs in
that
situation.
What's an average score in the first innings of a test
match? About 300, maybe a bit less. I think batters around the world average about 300.
And we got just over a third of
that. So I'm saying if you play, but I think in this match runs are worth about double. So 112 is not a good score on this pitch, on any pitch.
66, 80 is not that much different, is it? The points
don't stretch it. There's a big difference between 100.
Let's get away.
I think from there, England really needed, they had the opportunity to, they only needed to be, if they got 100 ahead, they were in a good position, and they were unable to do that. And I think that's a lot of that is to do with the pitch. A lot of that is to do with some pretty poor batting, isn't it?
I think that also kudos needs to be given to the Indian team. They played really well, I thought. I thought the Axar bowled really well, Ashwin bowled really well. And regardless if the pitch is made for you or not made for you, you've still got to do it. Yeah. And then the way in which Rohit Sharma and Gill came out in the second innings, I think we tweeted it about an hour before it happened, and we were always going to lose by 10 wickets in that scenario. I thought they were brilliant.
Yeah, I don't think you can really talk that much about the final innings. I mean, like, England knew they'd lost. Joe Root opened the bowling in a test match. No one's really set up for that. I think, like you say, it was inevitable.
You are right to credit India, Ross, because they did again outplay England in pretty much all aspects, apart from their part-time spin.
Right, so that brings us to sort of the last of the talking points that we're going to have before we really get rid of this test. And we talked, so we're going to talk about the pitch a little bit, but probably from a different angle, I think, because we did talk about the pitch, for 20 minutes or so on the last show. And it was pretty funny, wasn't it? to be honest, like the combination of that wicket with like the plastic pink ball did lead to some sort of hilarious stuff going on. I think we sent round a tweet from Hawkeye that Jared Kimber had shared of an Ashwin over where all the balls bouncing about the same place, and one went past Joe Root's head, one hit middle stump, two span miles down the leg side, and two slid straight on. It was at that point in the game, it was about as close to unplayable as I think you can get.
Yeah.
But what's been interesting...
And before you get into the pitch, Jack, how much of that do you think was the pink ball aspect? Because I don't, in terms of like compared to Chennai, I don't think the pitch was worse than that at all. And I do feel like the pink ball with how it slid on did add sort of just the extra, just enough extra peril to make it that much more difficult to play.
Well, I think it's a combination thing, isn't it? It's the pitch was bad because they prepared a wicket that didn't take into account that they were going to be using a pink plastic ball. There's like guidelines. Ross was talking about that. You're supposed to have a certain amount of grass on the wicket. You generally want it to look. You need to do a little bit more to make the ball interact with that wicket like a regular red ball. You can't just roll out a spinner as we've seen. The spinning wicket, as we've seen, like probably a pitch that would have gone to like day four with a red ball. I don't think it was as bad as the Chennai one. It wasn't going through the top of the wicket. The bounce was reasonably consistent when it didn't hit the lacquer. But we were playing with a pink ball, and that makes it a bad pitch. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Anyway,
you need about 7 feet of grass to make it actually the pink ball worth it.
What I thought actually was quite interesting was the debate around the pitch. I don't know if any of you, either of you two have been sort of looking at any of that on the line, as they say.
I've seen a lot of
the Twitter army getting their knickers in a twist, which has been quite good fun. I've sort of kind of switched off from what the actual journalists are saying because they all seem to have very similar opinions. But I do enjoy the furore on Twitter. It's good. Yeah. There's a good battle going on.
It's just very cricket, isn't it? I just absolutely love the fact that there were still two innings worth of cricket played and no one is talking about that. It is focused on the pitch of something that, I find it thoroughly amusing.
Yeah, well, I think probably the reason for it, and I think the reason why I found it interesting is that, you know, when we talk about cricket on the Cricket Podcast, normally the angles we look for when we tell the stories are ones related to the human factor. They're not so much about numbers. We're not like reviewing players out of 10 or whatever. We want to tell each other and talk about the emotional moments of the cricket match. And I think, you know, what's interesting in this one is that most of the emotional moments in the cricket match happened after the cricket match on the internet. the actual discussion of whether the pitch was suitable or not has been way, way, way more interesting than what probably like it's a 10-wicket win, a bit of a hammering for one of the teams, and the cricket itself wasn't that great because nobody knew what they were doing. I don't know if you caught, to sort of kick this off, I don't know if you caught the sort of Grand Prince of cricketing thought, Ravichandran Ashwin's exchange with journalist. Did you see that, Max?
I did, yes. the journalist asked him what he thought of the pitch and whether he'd like to see a similar pitch in the next test. And Ashwin shot back being like, well, let me ask you a question. Who decides what a good pitch is? And if the journalist had done any of his research, he would have been able to then go back to Ravi Ashwin and say, well, the ICC does, and here are the guidelines, rather than making Ashwin look like some genius who's tied him in knots. But actually, the question Ravi Ashwin asked was... Completely answerable and in no way answers any questions. But it's very easy to sit there from the position of someone who is a world-class bowler and is bowling on a pitch that helps him out quite a lot.
See, I think, Max, and I think this is why the pitch and the whole debate around the pitch has been so interesting, because it's what this pitch is a perfect reflection of the type of cricket fan you are. So what you've done there is when you've been asked, like, is this pitch good, you've immediately gone to the rule book, because that, at the end of the day,
rules man.
Is the kind of cricket fan you are. You're a guy who likes the rules, you like things being the way they should be. Ashwin, I mean, the point he's making there, I wasn't really sure whether he was making this like clever postmodernist point, i.e. that there's no objective truth in the world, is there?
What even is
it? What exactly, Max? Yeah. Or maybe he's being a cricketing Marxist and sort of making this point that I guess the perception of what a good cricketing pitch is defined by England fans and Australian fans, and it is a Western-centric idea, and that the rising power of India is now in a position to take ownership of that discussion.
They're coming for Max's rule book. That's what they're coming for.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, I think, Max, kind of like you alluded to, It was just Ashwin talking saying that the pitch was, you know, quite good, because he's a professional sportsman.
Well, he's not. And Rohit's also done it, and Kohli's also done it. It's the theme from the Indian camp is that the pitch was absolutely fine, which I find a little disingenuous. But
and also, I mean, from Ashwin's point of view, he's just taking his 400th wicket. He doesn't want that undermined by some bloke or
no,
two,
that's
does
true,
he?
That like, is true.
Anyway,
it's still a phenomenal achievement.
Just to run through, because some of the perspectives, and then we'll call it a day. There have been some good ones. First of all, the England diehard fans. They've been saying the India cheated.
No, get in the bin.
There's no black and white, is there, at all? It is literally just, if England lose, someone else has cheated.
That's, you know, like, it's very hard to make what's basically a living organism.
It's an absolutely ridiculous take.
I think India prepared it like that, but they cheat, no. And then on the other hand, you've got the diehard India fans who tell you one combination of England can't bat, and this is just how pitches are in India. Both of which are pretty disingenuous as well, I would say. England scored 578 two tests ago. That's granted, completely different circumstances, but that's not a team that can't bat. This England team can actually bat.
It's also those fans who are really just saying that they're not Test cricket fans. They're just like, oh, it's completely reasonable that a Test finished within a day and a half. That's just not a reasonable place to be.
Yeah, some people were saying, is this good for Test cricket? It's more exciting. It's like, no, it's not.
See, these are
because it makes people go, well, why do you need 5 days if you can do it in two?
This is it.
And then Test cricket dies.
You're just getting a reflection of what you want out of the pitch. Because what you are there, Max, and I've got these all written down, you're coming from the position of like a cricket lover. I just want a good game. The game should last the length that a normal Test match should last.
I mean, it doesn't have to go 5 days, but you know, I mean, you can't say that some of the best moments in cricket haven't been those ones that have gone down to the wire. You know, like those tight wins you've got, and it just builds, doesn't it? It's the whole point of the long form of the game, is there are so many moments where it ebbs and flows, and the pressure builds. It's nip and tuck until that final moment where the ultimate result is decided. And what we got was, it was basically like a 2020 version of Test cricket.
Yeah, well, you say that, Max. I think that if you put that on the internet, somebody would retort to you from the cricketing progressives camp, because what you have, that's my doorbell, what you have described there, Max, is a cricketing conservative point of view. To rip off Edmund Burke, you're talking about cricket from the point of view of a game that we're just sort of the custodians as the living. Like Test cricket, it's not a game for the dead, it's not a game for the living, it's not a game for the people who are yet to be born. It's a holistic thing that we take care of and pass on to the next generation. A cricketing progressive, they come at you and they would say, you're wrong. This is completely fine. Just because that's how things were doesn't mean that's how things should be.
Yeah.
Now, I think,
I mean, the traditionalistic fallacy is a real thing, and I totally take the argument that just because something is a certain way doesn't necessarily mean it should remain that way. But you know, the cricketing progressives gave us the 100, so
I mean,
that would be my response.
Which I'm a big fan of the 100.
I also think that cricketing progressives are coming at it from a really half-baked intellectual point of view. Half of them, in my opinion, are their sycophantic panderers to the BCCI, the Indian public, or both, and have developed that kind of justification just because they're really desperate for
mental gymnastics.
Yeah, you know. And then some of them are fundamentally good, and they are progressive people in normal life. But instead of applying that progressive tendency to people and making the world a better place, they've applied it to some dirt in India. They're just severely confused. Anyway, I'm not going to labour this point anymore. I just thought it was really interesting, all these the different like ideas that were floating around based on some dirt. And like, basically, I'm going to forget what happened in this cricket match. Probably already forgotten most of it. Ollie Pope being bowled by Ashwin twice is the only thing I think I might remember beyond sort of next week, because that was absolute mastery, particularly in the second innings. But, you know, beyond that, who cares?
Well, the England team have done a very good job of stonewalling it for all the noise that's been created by journalists and you know, the usual ex-cricketers and the gang. We should probably come up with a name for them at some point. But the England team, despite some of what you might have picked up on the stump mics, which was actually quite funny. I don't know if you... There was definitely a bit where there was an image of James Anderson who was probably mouthing, "It's a fucking shithole." And and definitely heard, I definitely heard either Ben Stokes or Stuart Broad say, this is day one, what an absolute joke. And Stuart Broad did ask the umpire if they could put some concrete in the pitch at one point when they got the basher out. But that aside, the England team haven't really been, you know, there were a couple of like maybe minor comments, but they haven't really been complaining about the pitch at all. They've owned the fact that they probably didn't bat very well. Jack Leach, even as recently as today, said that, you know, India outplayed us and we need to be better. And I think from the English team's point of view, that's the right mental attitude to have. And perhaps some of the journalists should sort of maybe just take a moment to read what the England players are actually saying and let them make the decision. Because they, at the end of the day, did play on the pitch.
Right. I think that's a good point to draw a line under the third test. If we're all agreed, should we take a quick break and then come back with a little preview of test four?
I can't wait to get you to the Gabaresh. Tell you what.
Can't wait to get you to the Gabaresh. Tell you what.
It's full. It's down the ground. There'll be at least one. Saini has got an injury with the groin. It goes as far as the fence. India, incredible. Rishabh Pant is the star. India win the test.
Welcome back to the Cricket Podcast, part two of our show. This is the preview of India v England test four. We're going to have a little chat about that. We should just mention as well, because some people will be joining us on YouTube for like the first time right now, and they'll be like, what the fuck is he talking about, part two? This is part two of a two-part show, and you can go and find the other part, which is a recap of the third test somewhere else. For the people on audio, sorry that I just annoyed you by talking about that. We will be previewing this, and then we'll move on to the PSL and New Zealand v England women, and New Zealand v Australia as well. But yeah, you know, I've talked for long enough. Ross, preview, talk to me.
Yes, so England can draw in India, which it would be a pretty big achievement, I think. I was going to say monumental, but maybe the context of the of England not hitting over 200 runs in the last five innings, it would be pretty monumental. I think, and they would have taken that position. I think they'd take the position they're in now before the series started. I think they'd take being 2-1 down going into the final test match, I think. But the rotation circus could well see a few more clowns come out from behind the curtain. So let's have a quick run through of what we're likely to see. Crawley, probably done enough to retain his space, as has Sibley. I don't think they're going to change that opening partnership. Johnny Pairstow, the Frankenstein monster that cannot be killed. What's going to happen there, do we reckon? Is there going to be a bit of a shake-up? Is the option that you bring Burns back in and drop Crawley to three, bring Dan Lawrence back in, Or did they treat Johnny Bairstow quite harshly by just dumping him in this game and him getting back-to-back zeros?
I think they'll 100% play him.
Yeah?
I would. If you do play him, I wouldn't play him at three. You could argue that they treated him harshly by bringing him back and dumping him in. But he's not a number three. He's not a test number three anyway. And we have Zach Crawley, who has been playing there and has shown that he can do the job. So I would have Burns opening with Sibley and Crawley at three. And if you want to play Bairstow, then you can bring him in further down the order.
For clarity, I would 100% agree with what Max said, and I think they should have done that for the third test as well. Not that it would have made
it's just what we think, what you think England will do.
Yeah, it's what I think England will do is stick with Pesto, because they'll
golden boy.
He's the golden boy, and they'll be trying to justify this rotation policy somehow, and the way they justify that is Johnny Pesto miraculously scoring a series leveling century, isn't it? So they can't deprive themselves of the opportunity for justification.
That is so. I love that. Put some money on that. So Max, in the world of what should happen, does that mean that Ollie Pope drops out of the 11 for you?
Yeah, I think given the rotation policy, and he's come back from a nasty dislocated shoulder, not played a huge amount. I think just take him out the firing line for this last test. He was all at sea against Ashwin. He really didn't know whether his right leg was his left arm or. So I think just for his sort of his sake, maybe just take him out and let him dust himself off and bring him back for some of the tests against New Zealand.
So Max is saying the right thing to do. 100% agree with all of that, especially as Pope's not going to the IPL. So if England do this thing where they let the guys at the IPL play the whole of the IPL and miss the New Zealand series, or at least the first test, Pope, you'll need him back for that. I think, let's not destroy England's future. Let's not sacrifice him at the altar of Ravi Ashwin. but we will. I'm going to play the role of what we will do. And I don't think that I don't think they'll find the drop button. I think their philosophy when it comes to batters is to give them at least one too many goes before they jettison someone, rather than one too few. Or that's how they'll phrase it. I mean, I would say they're probably giving them two or three too many in some situations.
As I said, this is an opportunity to level a series. I think drawing in India would be a huge achievement for any team right now, and England still have that opportunity. So I think they need to play their best team. Root's going to play, Stokes will play, Folks is obviously going to have to play. But that moves us on to the bowling lineup, which England got a little bit wrong in the last test match, and that's okay. I kind of touched upon it in the first part of the show, but There is an opportunity here for England to roll out one of their tried and tested techniques of giving a spinner one test match at the end of a tour that's not going so well. But this time it's going to be in favourable conditions. It's not being 4-0 down in Australia and going, there you go, mate, have a go.
Graham Swan's retired, so good luck.
Yeah, exactly. So in this case, I'm not sure how much they trust Don Bess. I mean, Jack, you kind of hypothesised that he may well have the yips when he bowled in the fourth innings of the last test match that he played in. So that would mean options of going to Mason Crane, going to Matt Parkinson or Amivirdi. Do you see a path for any of those guys coming into the test match for the fourth test?
I can't see it, to be honest. Purely for the point of balance for the side, we've just picked
Gary Balance.
Yeah, we've got Gary Balance back.
Gary Balance is coming back.
We've just picked a bunch of bowlers, a nice four-man tail, and that didn't go so well. So we're kind of stuck, really, with we have to play another spinner, and you've got to bring Don Bess back and try and get his head in the right place after having jettisoned him, discarded him like yesterday's old newspaper. Matt Parkinson's got a first-class batting average of 5. So he's not the man for the job. Amivirdi's batting is about as good, and I think his fielding might be about as good as well. So, yeah, for me, it's I think they probably do they probably still believe that Don Best can be England's test spinner? And he offers that, you know, the right arm, left arm option alongside Leach. So I think it's got to be Best.
Yeah, I think that's the sad realisation that they'll probably come to. I mean, there is another point of view to take on all of this, I would say. Ross, you're a man of the art world, aren't you?
Sometimes,
yeah. So you'll know that in the history of art, some of the greatest pieces have been created out of hardship and difficulty. Picasso's Guernica, obviously coming after the bombing of Guernica. Van Gogh's magnum opus, Starry Night, came in the aftermath of his breakdown and self-mutilation when he was in an asylum. Now I'm sitting here and I'm wondering, after the last couple of tests, where England have, you know, they've been mauled, they've gone to a dark, dark place, whether there is an artistic genius, a maverick genius out there, who's possibly brewing up a masterpiece himself. Now, I'm going to cut the metaphor a little bit, and I'm just going to ask you straight up, Ross. Could Ed Smith be freaky here? Because you're asking the questions, you're trying to get us to speculate on it. What do you think he could do?
I think he could tear it all up, couldn't he? He could tear it completely up. This could be the Ed Smith kind of renaissance, if you will, of the England side. I would love it to. It's going to be a red ball. It's going to be a turning pitch. Why don't we try and match India? Why don't we try and go for the three spin option? We know. Why don't we do it? Why don't we have Leach in the side? Why don't we have Best in the side? Well, if not Best, Root's going to have to bowl for you. But bring in Parkinson. I think now is the time for a Crane or a Parkinson. A leg spinner is exactly what should be on the menu if I'm Ed Smith.
So who drops out then?
Stuart Broad. Stuart Broad goes.
Stuart Broad, Archer, or Anderson. Two of them. If I were in charge, I would have the top three we talked about a while ago. I'd probably keep Bairstow in for just one more test and give Pope a little rest. That would be my top six sorted out. I might move Folks above Bairstow because he actually looks like he's got a clue. then down the order, yeah, I would be really tempted because from England's point of view, in the World Test Championship cycle, this is a free hit. Like they cannot make the final. All they can do is send Australia to the final. There's no good outcome from England's point of view here. India or Australia are going. They're going to, if they win, they send Australia to the final. If they lose, oh well, they won a test. You know, they got more than anyone expected out of this series.
Well, and tied the series. Yeah.
If they win, yeah, then they've tied the series in India. They probably won't do that ever again. you might as well. I say, yeah, let someone loose because it's not. Let's be honest. India, if they've got half a brain, which it appears they do, they're just going to roll out something that spins quite a lot in this last test. And England are going to go down again looking really, really bad. So, you know, throw in the mystery spinner, hope for the best.
Mm-hmm.
What are India
Archer
up to?
Archer is a lone seamer with Stokes, or Anderson is a lone seamer
with Archer bowling left arm spin, mate.
I actually think they'll probably drop Archer. I don't think he'll play. I think they're going to value the one day series and the T20 series quite highly after being embarrassed here. So I can see him being dropped out. I thought Ollie Stone did well. Mark Wood has been added to the squad. He's come back now, so there's options there. But I would really, really like them to see a new spinner. I just think it would be a positive step in what has been a relatively negative couple of test matches.
I always like to see a leg spinner.
Agreed.
I would be well up for that.
Right.
Okay. India. Yes, so India. So India, obviously, you don't really change a winning side normally, but in typical Indian Twitter and Indian media, there has been a couple of questions raised around Ajinkya Rahane's position in the side.
Recently, he had a really bad job captaining the side, didn't he, overseas in really troubling conditions?
Yeah, there is a bit of short-termism when it comes to this and a bit of rage, which I think just isn't really justified. Yes, he's only averaged 19 2021, which isn't great for your number five. However,
you've got to give everyone a chance. He is the... No, that isn't what you were going to say. I thought that was what you were going to say. No, carry on.
We're not quite finishing each other's sentences yet, Jack. But without Rahane, I think that Indian squad actually lacks that leadership capability. I don't think Kohli is a great leader when it comes to cricket. He has got a good record, but he's got some great lieutenants around him. And I think that you need the yin and the yang, Max, that you talked about a couple of shows ago. And I think Rahane is that to Kohli. I think everyone knows about the kind of relationship, whether it's good or bad, is up to you to decide, between Rohit Sharma and Kohli, and that kind of power struggle between two kind of behemoths of the modern game. Whilst the likes of Ashwin and Pujara, they are focused on being the best cricketer they can be in their role in that test team. They are not focused on leading that team. So I don't think that they can actually justify dropping Rahane, especially, Max, as you say, after the Australian kind of heroics that came out of his brain. But also, I think they would lack a real leader. What do you think?
I probably agree with that. I don't see why they would, really. Mm-hmm. I think just from the point of view of not changing a winning team, I think you should keep him. What's the alternative? I mean, have you got some options that you can tempt me with?
No, not really. I mean, you're not going to pick Vihari. Oh, he's a bit boring.
Probably
when it comes
not.
To...
Agarwal? People have occasionally said that he could come in and maybe bat six or maybe send someone down the order. But I just don't think you need to. Yeah, I don't really see it. What were you going to say?
Well, so the issue that is in play is that Bumrah has been sent home. He's got, I think, his personal issues that he needs to deal with. Don't know what it is, so wish him all the best. But he's going to be replaced by either Siraj or Umesh Yadav into the side. But if I'm a selector for India in this scenario, I'm gearing the side up with another batsman. So Washington didn't really do anything, did he, in the last test match, and because it didn't run too often. But is Washington Sundar actually a better batsman than Agarwal? Probably not. They've shown that with Axar and Ashwin, they've already got spin covered. Ishan and Umesh, or Siraj, who comes in, can bowl the rest, so that's fine. India's position now is that they can either draw the match or win the match, and they're into the final. All they need to do is avoid losing. I don't think England will be able to bowl out all of their batsmen twice if they pick another batsman, and I think they probably still have the bowling to take 20 of the English wickets.
Yeah, I don't know why they do that, though. I mean, I think they can beat England with the team that they had, swapping around Bumrah. I don't think they need to overthink this. I mean, they might.
I mean, they didn't have Bumrah in the second test. That didn't really matter much, did it?
No, exactly. If I were an India fan right now, I'd feel pretty good about myself. If I were an Indian cricketer, I'd be feeling even better and a lot richer about myself. but I'm looking at this. I mean, I can't logically see why you would swap any of those players from the second test for this one. England's shot. Why would you change it?
I'm on the same page as you, mate, but we do a cricket podcast where we're trying to offer a different bit of an opinion, and bringing in Agarwal as a... we're going to play eight batsmen. This is what the approach we're going to go in.
I mean, they could do that. If they really wanted to draw it, why not just play 11 batsmen? We've never seen anyone have we? We haven't seen anyone play 11
batsmen. We've seen Rohit Sharma. Yeah, we've seen Rohit Sharma's pies, haven't we? Anyway, so I think what we're going to end up with is a strong India side. England should shuffle the deck. So let's have a couple of predictions. Max, final test is 2-1 in the series. Are England going to claw it back, or is it going to be 3-1 India?
3-1 India for me, I'm afraid. I think we'll put up a bit better fight this time round. At least I certainly hope we do. But I can't see anything other than India taking it 3-1.
Okay.
Jack? I think probably India. I think, to be honest, we have to acknowledge that there is the wild card draw in here. We've sort of said, or Ross, you just said like a minute ago, that India only need a draw to get to the World Test Championship final. We've seen in the last two tests that they are happy to be a little bit creative with their curation of the wickets. So would it stun you if this turned out to be like a 600 place 500 type surface? They're probably under a little bit of pressure on the old pitch front after the last two as well. So I think there's the possibility that they put out a real flatty. Probably though, they just put out something that spins again because they're India and they know they'll win if they do that. In a way, putting out a wicket that spins loads against this England side is less of a risk, isn't it, than producing a wicket that looks like it will create a draw, but might lead to a Joe Root double century.
Yeah, and a Matt Parkinson tenfer. I think that I'm going to go with the England win. I'm going to go that England pull it out of the bag. No one's expecting it. No one was expecting them to win the first test. So 2-2 in the end for me.
Cool. Should we take a...
What have you been drinking?
Really quick break. Really quick break. And then we'll come back with just the odds and sods, the bits that we haven't talked about yet.
We love hearing from our listeners. So please follow us at The Cricket Pod on Twitter and Instagram. Or if you have a great story, like Scotty G did, about The Haydon Way, Matthew Haydon's personal website, we want to hear about it. So from wherever you're from, send us in a great story and we'll read out on the show. Email us on thecricketpod@gmail.com. Thank you very much.
So to kick off the final third of the show, let's talk some women's cricket. The England women's team... are in action in New Zealand. They won two of their three ODIs against New Zealand women to take that series 2-1, being derailed in the final match by a super century from New Zealand's Satterthwaite. Besides the brutal time difference, which is one of our favourite topics on the show, but actually because we like it so much, is something we've had to permanently ban from discussion. the main talking point is probably that this is the first women's 50-over match played by the England team for 15 months. Not an ideal set of circumstances, Ross.
No. I think it's always been quite challenging between kind of female and men's sports. I think the inequality between the two setups was kind of well known. But in cricket, there were some positive strides to a more equal footing with some people getting proper contracts, etc. However, the pandemic has pressed pause on that kind of momentum that was being built up. The difference is stark, and there's no doubt that sportswomen have been let down, I think. It's probably fair to say, especially the cricketing sphere. And that goes from not only the lack of games, as you mentioned, Jack, but also kind of access to equipment, as well as even the chance to be in a bio bubble around anywhere. There wasn't seemingly that proactive nature. The Women's World Cup was pushed back not 1 year, but 2 years around this. So it's been a bit of a tough time. I think it also comes down to some of the financial support that is provided, or in a lot of the cases not provided, due to those contracts that are in place. So a lot of people are paid on kind of training camps and match fees rather than some of the contracts in place. So this isn't a problem just in international cricket or just cricket in general. And there are a couple of good articles that you can read on Red Brick by Sophie Utteridge and on The Conversation by Ali Bowles, which are definitely worth reading in this space.
Yeah. Matt, on the topic of the actual cricket, who impressed you? Or did you manage to catch any of it? Because it was on in the middle of the night. We should acknowledge we're probably... I certainly wasn't up at 3 a.m.
Yeah, no. despite England very magnanimously getting their test matches out of the way in time for everyone to watch the one day. For me, it's got to be the player of the series, isn't it? Tammy Beaumont scored 71, 72 and 88 in the three games and was only out once. So quite deserving of a player of the series award. Excellent, really set up England's two chases really nicely and basically only didn't score more in the third innings because she ran out of people to bat with. So yeah, excellent performance from her. But I think also probably fair to give New Zealand a mention for roaring back in style, as you mentioned, in that third ODI after being soundly beaten in those first two. And they ended a run of 11 ODIs without a win in doing that. So that was a nice moment for them, who they're clearly not a terrible team. So 11 games without a win was doing them a disservice.
Are they in women's cricket? I don't know. So the narrative in the men's game is they're the good boys, they're the nice guys. Are they the good girls, the nice girls in the women's game, Max?
I can only assume
probably
so.
It's just they're just a nice nation, aren't they?
Kiwis, they're just lovely, aren't they?
I did catch one of the beginnings of one of, or the, I caught the beginning of one of the matches. I was quite impressed by Catherine Brunt, who's basically bowling loads of bouncers, which is always good. She was rested for the final ODI, which England lost, and that's always a good thing from a personal point of view, isn't it? To miss out when the team loses, because then people start.
talking about you being the answer.
It's that absence bias again.
Exactly. There was another funny thing related to this game. Alex Hartley, has anyone got the tweet up in front of them, or can they paraphrase it?
I think I've got it here. So it was after England lost
the England men's team.
Yeah, the England men's team. Rory Burns dropped for the side, was feeling obviously a bit sorry for himself, and decided, you know what? The women have had it so good and men have had it so badly over the last few years in cricket and in life in general. He said, he responded to Hartley's tweet. Hartley said, nice of the England boys to get this test match finished just before England women play tonight, with some clapping emojis afterwards. So a bit tongue-in-cheek. And Rory Burns took a particular offence. And Jimmy Anderson and Ben Stokes both liked this, by the way. But Burns came back with a very disappointing attitude, considering all the boys do to support the women's game. Max, you're a big Surrey fan. Was this a bit of a misstep from old Rory?
Yeah, I'm afraid it was. I think maybe he might have a little too thin a skin on this one, because from my point of view, there is it's just a bit of fun, isn't it? And you have to consider that Alex Hartley is, I mean, at the moment her main role is a broadcaster, you know, working for the BBC and BT, and you know, she was plugging some of the BT coverage. So you can, from that point of view, it's clearly just intended as a joke. It's like, now we can focus on the women's game against New Zealand. Now England have got the test team out of the way. Yeah, just have a bit of fun. And Rory Burns has not covered himself in glory. I'm sure it was just. I'm sure he regrets it. But it's just one of those things where it's like, it's a bit. He's obviously taken it the wrong way. It's a bit silly. But on something like Twitter, like rightly or wrongly, you have to think a little bit more about what your reactions are gonna result in, because Twitter is unfortunately at times a very toxic place. And if you give people the opportunity to pile on, they will gladly grab it with both hands and throw as much abuse as they can, which supports whatever agenda they have. So I think you have to be a little more aware of your surroundings with those sort of things. Like as a comment on its own, it's a bit childish, but I think sort of the fact that what's continued afterwards from other people, you need to be a little bit more thoughtful.
Yeah. A full
I think that's just PSHE. I think that's just one from Max. I think that's just one big thing to try to get the internet to stop saying he looks like Ed Sheeran rather than anything else.
Max. What I liked about Rory Burns, or what I thought was funny, was that he hadn't tweeted since like August last year, so he'd obviously seen it, like,
dusted it off.
This is the
he
issue.
Probably had to. He actually probably had to go through the whole password reset process to be able to
accept,
get into Twitter to
accept
make
some new
comment.
Terms and conditions. I should stick to haircuts. Also in New Zealand, the Aussie men have been taking on the Kiwi men. And not doing such a great job of it, Ross.
No, so there's a 5-match T20 series going on at the moment, and New Zealand are currently 2-0 up. Due to the snap lockdown because of a coronavirus case in Auckland, the two games will now be played at Wellington behind closed doors, which is a shame, because when I was watching the highlights, it was great to see all of the crowd kind of at the cricket ground. So they were playing at the University Oval in Dunedin, I think I'm saying that correctly. And it was just great to see, really. The second T20 was a really close contest. Martin Guptill is back, is the big news. He took over Rohit Sharma as the man with the most T20 international sixes. Owen Morgan is third, if you're wondering. He did at this ground, so the University Oval, there were some boundaries that were less than 60 metres long. So,
Sharjah.
Yeah, it was. I mean, if there was a place to play an international 2020, this is the one if you want a gluttony of runs. And it didn't really disappoint. Kane Williamson was good. That's unsurprising to anybody. And only one of the Australian bowlers went for under 10 and over. And that was Jai Richardson, new millionaire, who went at 9.75.
Still under 10, though, isn't it?
Sure
job
is.
Done.
Jimmy Neesham was the star of the show, hitting 45 not out off of 16 balls, including 3 sixes off the first 3 balls of his innings. So he was in fine form, and then was entrusted with the final over of the innings, where he got Daniel Sams, who was had a bit of the Neesham juice, who was on 41 off of 15 balls, and our podcast favourite Marcus Stoinis. And saw New Zealand home to a 4-run victory. So it was great. If you want to watch the highlights, it's on the BT app, and I can highly recommend it. The biggest highlight for me was where Glenn Maxwell took a catch and dismissed Santner, and then turned around to the crowd and literally was just like, come on. And he'd started giving it back to the crowd, so which was great to see.
Good.
The one thing that I was sort of interested in that series is the performance of the new very expensive Carl Jameson Chris Morris replacement, and he's been carted around for 88 runs off 7 overs, picking up 1 wicket so far. So hopefully he can turn that form around by the time he lands in India.
RCB, that's such an RCB move, isn't it? Picking a guy who got Kohli out a couple of times a year ago.
So the funny thing was, so Matt Wade, and he's what, 5 foot two, 5 foot three, Matt Wade, and he was just bowling back of a length to him, and Wade was just knocking it over the keeper for six. It was a completely new way of playing Jameson, so it was really fun.
Should we wrap up with a little bit of PSL then, Max?
Yeah, so the PSL is very much underway. We're 11 games in now, and the 11 games have all been won by the chasing team, which is a nice little stat. Peshawar's Almi and the Lahore Calendars are leading the table so far.
So they've won the most tosses wins. Then, basically.
Yeah, three wins and one defeat each. It's been, I don't know how much of it you guys have watched, but it seems to have been, from my point of view, pretty high quality stuff so far. Some of the top performers, like Mohammed Rizwan, Shahjul Khan, Fakhar and Babar, have all been amongst the runs. And a few other notable names in the batting front are Chris Gayle, Alex Hales, James Vince, Faf, all over there and all in the runs. And then from the bowling front, Saqib Mahmood is leading the wickets table with 10 from Shaheen Afridi and Wahab Riaz. And for me, all obviously it's very difficult for political reasons, and we won't get into Indo-Pakistani relations because it's not a good idea.
I think we should.
But I really do hope that in the near future we can see some of these guys in the IPL, because the quality is there. They are high class players, and they would only improve, I think, the IPL by seeing some of these. I absolutely love Shaheen Afridi. I think it's brilliant. I think he's an absolutely cracking player, and obviously people know how good Babar Azam is, and
he likes to bowl a Yorker. That's what I like to see. As a left-armer, like, Stark has a great Yorker. Shaheen Afridi has a really good Yorker as well. And it's just amazing to see someone actually deliver it with such aplomb.
And if he got the opportunity to play in the IPL, he probably wouldn't cry off before the auction every time.
It's interesting, the PSL, because there's a batting second in T20s is an advantage. I think you win about 55-60% of the games, so there is, it's
no 100, mate.
Well, I was just gonna carry on to that. it's the most distinct advantage you get in cricket. So in test cricket and the other formats, you can work that out at home. It's not such an advantage to bat second, but it is a big one in T20s, and even more pronounced in the PSL. I think it's something like 80% of games last year and the year before were also won by the team batting second. I wonder what they'll do to figure that out. Maybe that can feature as our question of the week sometime soon. But it probably does need a little bit of a rebalance there.
What is it? Is it the Jew factor?
I suspect it's probably a little bit to do with the quality of spinners as well. Like a lot of the best bowlers are fast bowlers, and I wonder if that makes it just a little bit. Maybe it's the Jew, but maybe it's a little bit hard to control the run rate when you are bowling second in a way that isn't the case in other matches, and also you maybe there's just like less of a wicket taking threat in the middle overs because everyone's just bowling sort of 130 kilometers an hour instead of doing anything with the ball. Don't know. Interesting. I did catch a little bit. I've caught quite a lot of it actually. The best bit of the tournament, I think we could probably agree, or I don't know if you'd agree, was Shaheen Afridi bowling to Babar Azam. Did you see that?
I saw him get him out and put his arm around.
It didn't last very long, did it? No, yeah. Shaheen Afridi yorked him off stump out the ground. Middle stump sort of drunkenly leaning backwards. Bye-bye, Babar.
Mm-hmm. Mohamed Amir, everyone's favourite no ball specialist, also went round the park and lost his team the game, didn't he?
He did, yeah. So that it looked like the teams batting second were going to finally pick up a victory. They needed the team, I can't remember who it was, Ben Dunk was batting. They needed 30 something off the last two overs, and Amir went for like 22. David Visa was hitting sixes miles. I think he hit his first three balls for six or something like that.
Yeah, there's a few T20 blast veterans around in
you got a bit of Samit Patel.
Yeah.
Anyway, Alex Hales, of course. Shall we say goodbye to everyone?
Yes, everyone. If you want to subscribe, you should definitely do subscribe. So use this.
That's a great offer, Ross.
You just pointed at Jack there.
Did I? Yeah. It's just this one, you, Max. And also, if you've got ideas around or theories why the PSL and the second team batting second always wins, let us know. We'll try and solve some conundrums next week.
Good idea. What Ross said, like, subscribe. Goodbye.